Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. Good morning. I'm glad to see everybody on here already and ready to go. Look, most important thing I can tell you is next Sunday, this time next Sunday, we will be in the theater at Landmark Midtown Art Cinema. Pretty much everybody I know from Metron has been vaccinated. It's not a requirement for you to come. Please come anyway. If you want, even if you've been vaccinated and you want to wear a mask and you want to sit socially distanced, you can still do that. That's totally fine. It's going to be safe. I think, Avery, let's even have a box of disposable masks in case anybody wants one. So, you know, just cover all of our bases. That should be easy to obtain. But I'm looking forward to seeing everybody next Sunday at the theater, 11 o'clock. It is Metron's... You'll be there. Yay, Leona! Glad y'all are going to be there. It's just going to be Leona and me, apparently. I don't know if anybody else is coming. Anybody else coming next Sunday? We're going to be there at 11 a.m. And, you know, I haven't really planned a whole bunch of stuff. I haven't really planned singers. I just want to see you. I just want us to, for whatever the future holds, I want us to get in the theater and just kind of get a feel for what happens next. And Elisa, I know Elisa and Kevin are going to be there. Pam's going to be there. Good. Yay. Brenda's going to be there. Now, don't y'all lie up here on my rooftop. Y'all better, if you say you're going to be there, you better be there. Yes, it's going to be Kevin's birthday that day, and we're going to have lunch with him afterwards. And, Avery's getting disposable masks. Probably already got them, probably. Avery's one of those administrative assistants that when you think to mention it to her, she's already got it. Anyway, it's going to be great. Looking forward to seeing you at 11 a.m. It's real easy to find if you've never been there before. It's kind of not directly across from Piedmont Park, but it's Piedmont Park adjacent. There on Monroe Drive. If you're coming from the Conyers, Covington area, there's literally one turn. You go down I-20. The way I go is up, turn right on Boulevard. You'll pass the King Center. And you'll come right to it because Boulevard becomes Monroe. For those of you who in Rockdale County and Newton County say, "Oh, I can't drive in the city," it's Sunday morning. There's no traffic. If it was 5 o'clock on a Friday, you might have a valid point. But Sunday morning that time, it's not a ghost town, but it's definitely hardly any traffic at all. There's plenty of parking, which is rare. It's been one of the things I've loved most about these 7 years of being in the theater is it's one of the few places in Midtown that does have ample free parking. So it's going to be a great day. And then 2 weeks from today, we will be on magical, mystical St. Simon's Island. This will be our third meditation weekend there. This is number 11. We have done 10 of these. All 10 of them have been extraordinary. This one, I'm expecting no less. You know, right at the last minute, there's always some people that end up going that weren't planning on going, and some people who were planning on going were, like I know Robert and Robbie Joe were going to come, but then they found out school starts that week and they've got little ones, so it's totally understandable. But for those of you that have never gone, you've still got plenty of time. You can still find a room and just go. If you say you're a part of the Metron community, then be a part of the Metron community. Get off the bench, stop observing, and participate. And the great thing about these meditation weekends is you tailor make them. Some people just come for the Saturday. Some people just come for the Sunday. Some people come in early on Friday. Some people make a vacation out of it. Some people stay even after the thing's over with. The structure is based on the sun and the movements of the earth. We have a sunset meditation on Saturday and a sunrise meditation on Sunday. And other than that, I don't really give you a lot of specifics. If you want information, I can put you on the messenger thread. That does not obligate you in any way. But I'm telling you, as soon as you get on the messenger thread, you'll get it. you'll see how, oh, this is very easy to, and if you say, I don't do Messenger, look, it's 2021, get in the 21st century already. Download Messenger. Even if you don't have Facebook, you can be on it, and don't stop worrying about the government looking at your stuff. Nobody wants to see your stuff. Just log on and communicate with us. And then we have also September 5th, we'll be back in the theater again for a communion service. And then on October 23rd and 24th, we'll be in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I already have a large crowd of people, a large group of people who've already gotten rooms to be up there. And Chattanooga's beautiful that time of year, so you're going to love it. It'll be totally different from the St. Simon's one, but equally amazing. I'm telling you, I don't think it's too over the top to say that these meditation weekends will change your life. And it's one of those things where you just have to decide to go. I mean, you can find your own place. So some people do it through Airbnb, or, you know, they just find, like, there's some people, when we go to Jekyll or St. Simon's, don't even stay on the island. They stay in Brunswick. I guess it must be cheaper to stay there. So whatever works for you, you can make it as high dollar or low dollar as you want. But the main thing is that synergy that happens when we converge there on the beach. It really is. Beaches are already, they already have an amazing energy, but when you, and then when you add sunsets and sunrises on the beach, that takes it up another notch. And then when you got all these intentional people who have come there for the same reason, it doesn't even take long. It's like as soon as we walk out there, something is created in the atmosphere. And if you've never been before, when you get there, you'll know immediately what I mean. So next Sunday in the theater, 2 weeks from today, St. Simon's Island Meditation Weekend number 11. Give me some breaths here. Let's all breathe together, meditate together. We're going to inhale through the nose. It's all, meditation is very much about breathing, nitrous oxide. You breathe in through the nose, hold it, and exhale through the mouth. Let's go. Inhale. Exhale. In. Out. Give me three more. Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. Give me one more. In. I am serene. I am serenity. I am. I am peaceful. I am peace. I am. I am calm. I am calmness. I am. I am blessed. I am blessing. I am a blessing. I am. Something about breathing and affirming at the same time, it's very powerful. It gets you in touch with the deepest part of yourself. And it's a great thing to know how to do. You don't have to live in stress. I'm telling you, so much of your sickness comes from stress and trying to micromanage things. And letting stuff get to you that should never get to you. The most powerful thing that Jesus did on the boat was go to sleep. I'm telling you, sleeping sometimes is way more powerful than praying. Praying can be exhausting sometimes when you got this warfare mentality. When you've gone to the next level of consciousness where you can just say, we're crossing from point A to point B. Jesus said, let us go to the other side. We're going to the other side. Doesn't matter what the weather's like. It puts you at a whole other level. All right. I'll read your comments later. I can tell it looks like there's a lot of comments going on. And by the way, I love your comments. I'm all about some comments. So I never, even sometimes when you distract me a little bit, I still like to hear from you. It's all good. I'm sorry, I'm trying to get this exactly right. Seems like it could be a little lower to get me a little more in the screen. Maybe I better leave this alone. All right. What I want to share with you today. Oh, first of all, let me say thank you for your messages about my Uncle Harry Swilly, who transitioned a few hours ago. I actually have had two Uncle Harrys, and several people, I could tell when they were sending condolence messages, they were referring to Uncle Harry Meshuggah. He actually transitioned a few years ago. This was my Uncle Harry Swilly, who was my dad's younger brother. He was somewhere around a year younger, about 13 months, I think, maybe younger than my dad. And really powerful guy, alpha male. Interesting story about him that pertains to my other Uncle Harry. Usually when I tell Uncle Harry stories, I'm talking about Uncle Harry Meshuggah. He was the man who was married to my mom's oldest sister, Myrtle, who has also gone to the other side. And his family escaped the Armenian Holocaust at the early part of the last century and came to the United States. For some of you that have a history in the charismatic movement, his cousin was Dima Shakarian, that started the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship. And their name, Uncle Harry Meshuggah, their Armenian name originally was Meshuggah. Armenian names always end with I-A-N, like the Kardashians. They're Armenian. As a matter of fact, the Kardashians are distantly related to the Meshuggahs. Anyway, they sort of anglicized the name and it became Meshuggah. And Uncle Harry Meshuggah was the guy that I always talk about, who was, you know, really, really like a Old Testament prophet. I mean, on several occasions, I'd call him with an emergency, something, and he would make a decree, and it immediately happened. I'm talking, like, you think I'm good with the weather? Uncle Harry was totally next level with it. But years ago, Uncle Harry Swilly, who was never, he didn't go into the fivefold ministry like most of the men on both sides of my family did, but he was always very involved in, like, great Sunday school teacher, always very involved with church. But years ago, gosh, this has been probably close to 20 years ago, when he was not much older than me, maybe around my age, he was diagnosed with a radical kind of cancer. They just gave him days to live, and he was in his 60s at the time. And even before that, they had already slated him for this emergency surgery to remove his vocal cords, because it was like, I think it must have been throat cancer. So my dad asked him, he said, before you go in for this surgery, I want to bring Harry, meaning Harry Meshuggah, to pray for you. So he did. Uncle Harry Meshuggah went to meet Uncle Harry Swilly, and he prayed for him, and Uncle Harry said, you'll see your 80th birthday. And as soon as he said that, Uncle Harry Swilly began to get well, and he never had the surgery, and he lived to be 86. He saw his 80th birthday, like Uncle Harry Meshuggah said, plus six more years. And after that, he started going to all these mission trips, not where he was preaching, but he would go and build schools and orphanages and housing. And I mean, he really, in the latter part of his life, just was completely absorbed with missions work. So that was really cool. He had a lot of stories to tell about that. So he's there with my dad on the other side now, and he's been through a lot the last few weeks. So it's one of those things where it's a blessing for him to go on. And but thank you for your messages. I appreciate it. I was much closer to my mom's side of the family than I was to my dad's side. But you know, I love the Swillies, and even I will give this to Uncle Harry Swilly, because the most of the people on my dad's side Well, a good many of them on my mom's side. They're old school. And so they're, you know, they're religious, whatever, doesn't allow, they're not allowed to talk to me or acknowledge me or whatever. So, you know, it's just the way it is. But I remember when my Uncle Wallace passed, we were at the funeral home, and Uncle Harry, that's my dad's oldest brother, who was married to my mom's sister. He passed a year and a half ago, a couple years ago. And Uncle Harry Swilly, because Ken was with me at the funeral home, I saw him across the room, and he pointed to Ken and me, and I read his lips, and he said, "Is that him?" Pointing to Ken. And somebody said yes, and he says, "I want to meet him." And he came over and could not have been, I mean, all of Ken's family totally embraced me. You know, they're not really bothered with a lot of religiosity, but my family is, they have ministry reputations to protect, so, you know, it is what it is. But he came over and could not have been nicer and stood there and told us all these amazing stories. And my cousin Tony posted last night. My cousin Tony's on my Swilly side, and he's totally cool with me. And he said even when they left, he said, "Was that?" He called him his partner. He said, "Was that Jim Earl's partner?" And Tony said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, he seems like a nice guy." There was no lecturing about Leviticus, and you know, it was just nice to have that. It's so nice when people can step out of Phariseeism and just be human and just be nice. Too much bibliolatry makes people really, really mean. That's why Jesus told religious people, he said, "You're of your father, the devil." Religion comes from the devil. The devil fathered and sired religion. That's why Jesus said, that's what you Pharisees came out of, something demonic. So I have good memories of him. And then like the day before Dad passed, he came and told him goodbye. So, you know, nothing but good memories. And even that day when we left, my cousin Lori, who's a sweetheart, his daughter, she grabbed me and hugged me and said, "I'm so happy that you're happy." And she hugged Ken. And coming from them, for where they come from, that's huge. So, you know, baby steps. So that was nice. And it's kind of a good precursor to what I want to talk about today. In John chapter 4, there's a story about, it says that, it's in the beginning of chapter 4, it says that when Jesus heard that the Pharisees had found out that he was baptizing more people than John, he, for some reason, that made him want to get away from them. I'm not exactly clear as to why. I don't know if his publicity was getting out of hand. I don't know what it is. But they tried to get away from the Pharisees. And so where they were going from point A to point B and back to their hometown. And so the way they had to go was through the adjacent little nation of Samaria. It says they had to go through there. Now, Judea and Samaria were like hostile nations against one another. And the Jews were extremely prejudiced against the Samaritans. That's why when Jesus gave the parable of the Good Samaritan, why it was kind of controversial, because he makes a Samaritan the hero of the story. And even the fact that we refer to it as the Good Samaritan implies that most of the people didn't think the Samaritans were good. You had to actually define this one as good. But anyway, it says that he went to the well that was there in the city. I wish I had more time to explain to you what the culture would have been like at the time. I think a lot of fundamentalism comes from people reading ancient text and trying to understand it in modern context. So many things that Bible writers said 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, they themselves would be the first ones to tell us in the modern world. No, that's what we believed at that time. That was never meant to be a doctrine. That's why bibliolatry is so dark, and so perverted, because it makes it it, it well, what it does is it stores up manna. Manna is supposed to be given one day at a time, and when the Israelites stored manna, it got worm filled, which is why most Christian denominations have theologies filled with worms and decay. They're maggot infested because they're dying. And you know, when the writer of Hebrews says everything that's shaken, that can be shaken, will be shaken, he could just as easily have said everything that can die will die. And you know, we're in a world right now where there is a religious system that's dying off because it needs to die off so that the new heaven and new earth can be manifested. And so when it says that Jesus stopped, he stopped at Jacob's well, and the disciples went into the town to get him something to eat. Now, when we read that, we think, well, what's the big deal about a well? The well at that time in history, that was the place, that was the hub of the community. That's where all the women came in the morning to get, they didn't have running water. They would come to the big community well there. They would carry these big urns filled, and they'd fill it up with water, and that would be their water for the day. That's what they would wash with. That's what they would cook with. So when women came to the well in the morning, that was the place. It's kind of like what Facebook is now. That was the place where everybody swapped stories, swapped gossip. That's where all the women probably, and I don't know this for sure, but if you just know anything about the culture at that time, it seems likely that that would be the morning ritual, that the women would all, because the women were the caretakers at that time, and they would come get their water, and that was the time where you saw your girlfriends. That was the time where you had social interaction. And so the fact that Jesus sat himself down right in the middle of Jacob's well, right there in the community, was a very provocative move. I'm telling you, when you go back and look at all of these stories about Jesus talking to a woman, whether it was the woman at the well, or the woman who washed his feet with her hair, or the woman caught in adultery, or Mary and Martha, he not only was a feminist, he was a radical feminist. Like I told you the other day, when he told Martha that Mary had chosen the good part, technically Mary was acting like a man. Instead of being in the kitchen cooking with all the women, she went out there with the learned men and was listening to Jesus' lecture, which was just unheard of. If you ever saw Yentl, that was the whole thing, that Streisand's character, all she wanted to do was be able to learn, but in that culture, girls weren't allowed to go to yeshiva schools. They weren't allowed. Even Paul said, women, if you have a question, don't ask it in church, ask your husband at home. So the fact that Mary did not go cook for the men and sat there with Jesus was a very bold move. And the fact that Jesus defended it meant he was defying gender roles. And what's really interesting, you know, when I taught this the other day, I failed to mention this, but ever since around 2012, we ended the age of Pisces and we entered the age of Aquarius. And what's really interesting about Aquarius is Aquarius is sort of a gender non-specific figure, because it's a man pouring out, hang on, it's a fire truck. All right. Aquarius is a man who's basically acting like a woman. He's a man doing women's work. Men did not pour out the water urns. That was very gender specific. That was women's work. I mean, you know, I'm just not trying to punch people's buttons, but it's nearly like seeing a man in drag. I mean, it's like a man looking like a woman, acting like a woman. That's why even Not only does it not trouble me that sexual and gender ideologies are being challenged and altered, I think it's necessary. God is genderless. And so we're having to learn that, you know, much of our Bible came from the patriarchy. And instead of us just having a heavenly father, we have a heavenly parent that is neither male nor female, or is both male and female. Even in Genesis, it says that he created them male and female. Like everyone technically was created both genders. And if you ever watch how a fetus develops in the womb, you know, the X or Y chromosomes inform how they're going to develop, but they really, for a period of time, are neither and both. So, and even when Jesus defended the woman who washed his feet with her hair, that was really a feminist move too, because, you know, this is even true now. Women are judged differently for their sex lives typically than men are, especially in heterosexual world. You know, if a young man sleeps around, he's nearly applauded for it, or at least not applauded. It's tolerated. Like, well, he's just sowing his wild oats. If a woman does the same thing, if she has similar sexual appetites, she's a slut. And so when Jesus said to the woman, I'm getting back to the woman at the well, but I got to give you some context. When Jesus said about the harlot who washed his feet, which, by the way, let me say that it would take a woman who was comfortable being physical with men to even do a thing like that. I mean, if you read Luke chapter 7 in the Amplified Bible, it says, he defends her. He says, she not only has washed my feet with her hair, she has not ceased to kiss my feet and wash them with her tears this entire time. That's a very intimate act. And, you know, it would nearly have to be from a woman who kind of knew her way around a man's body. I mean, she knew, this is a woman who made her living seducing men or being sexual with men. Because that's kind of an intimate enough act that it made the man whose house it was, the Pharisee, remember it says he said in himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman she is. And Jesus defended her and said, I know what she is. I know what she does. Her sins, which are many, are forgiven because she loved much. That not only, you say, well, that's just a message of grace. No, that's also, that's a message of sexual empowerment, because he's basically saying, judge her sex life the way you would judge a man's. And the same thing is true for this story I'm telling you right now out of John 4. Because, you know, here Jesus comes right in the middle of all these women. So, again, I'm filling in the blanks here. I don't have chapter and verse for this. But I've been meditating this stuff my entire life. So, these pictures are very vivid for me. So, here, this is a place where all the girls hang out. This is where the girls talk. Men didn't go to the well. It would be like... It'd be creepy. It'd be like, what's a modern equivalent? It'd be like a man going to one of those women's gyms where it's, you know, whatever those places are where only women go. And here, in the midst of all these women, Jesus comes, sits down in the middle of them, and then a Samaritan approaches him, and he says to her, give me something to drink. Now, again, this is just unheard of, because he not only is completely ignoring gender, he's ignoring racial disparity as well. Because she says to him, excuse me, how is it that you, a man, says to me, a woman, give me something to drink? And furthermore, aren't you a Jew? And the Jews don't have anything to do with Samaritans. So just the fact that he says to her, give me something to drink. He's basically saying, I don't care about your gender. I don't care about your race. I don't care about your ethnicity. I'm operating at a higher level of consciousness. And the story goes on to say, she says, sir, I see that you have nothing to draw with. And he says, if you knew who was talking to you, you would know that I can give you living water, and if you drink this living water, you'll never thirst again. And she says to him, well, give me some of this water. Now, again, let me just explain to you, this is radical. Think about, unfortunately, this is kind of would be true now, but think about like a place in a white southern community 100 years ago and a black man sitting in the middle of everybody talking to this one girl. It would be scandalous. I mean, you know, y'all know the story of Emmett Till in Mississippi. He just whistled, and as it turns out, she even lied about it, but he was brutally murdered just because he whistled at a white woman, and he was just a kid. That happened in 1955. A lot of people think when the whole thing with the Montgomery bus boycott, when Rosa Parks refused to go to the back of the bus, a lot of times they cite that as the catalyst for the civil rights movement, but it was really, if you really study history, it was a few months before that because of Emmett Till, happened the same year. I'm only saying that to make a point. This was scandalous. A strange man is talking to a woman in the midst of all these married women, and they're just conversing. And even the fact that the woman says, give me some of this to drink, even that's pretty out there. Because typically, if a strange man had come to the well, a nice woman would have ignored him. And if he had asked her for something to drink, she'd be like, excuse me, you're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan. You know, why are you even talking to me? But she engages him, and she says, give me some of this water. And then he says, well, go call your husband. And just like that, she says, I don't have one. And he says, you have well said, I do not have a husband, because you've had five, and the man you live with now is not your husband. To which she replies, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Now, this is a very unusual exchange, because I would dare say, well, yeah, let me say it this way. When I look back now over most of the interaction that Jesus had in the Gospels one-on-one, which really, the Gospels spend more time telling stories about Jesus interacting with an individual, really more than they do with him preaching to the multitudes. So, what I notice a common thread with a lot of the people that he talks to. They kind of have either been through things in life that have been so scandalous or either so devastating that they don't really care what people think about them anymore. Like, they don't care. They've already been gossiped about, lied about, ridiculed. It's amazing how Jesus nearly always was drawn to the people who life had taken away their pretenses. Like, they just weren't playing games anymore. And this woman was one of those kind of women. The very fact that she said, I don't have a woman, this is my imagination. But what I visualize is, if she's been married five times and is now shacking up with some guy who might be one of these other women's husbands, I'm sure, this is how I see it, when she comes in the morning to get her water, I visualize the other women saying, oh, there she is, there's that skank, there's that... I mean, I venture to say she probably didn't have a lot of girlfriends. Typically, women who have a lot of men in their life don't have a lot of female friends. That's just kind of the truth. Whether they're promiscuous or not, just the fact that it's just a different world. And So this is a woman who's used to probably used to being snubbed by the other women, gossiped about, whatever. She's got to get her water, so whatever. I could tell you this. I reached a point years ago. I'd read so much stuff about me online. I'd been blogged about so much. I'd had so much hate mail from Christians. And Christians can write the meanest letters you've ever heard. Oh, my God, they're dark. But at a certain point, the volume of it was so much that I didn't even care anymore. It's like somebody could insult me, and I'm like, you think I haven't heard this 10,000 times? I mean, I got to where years ago, at one point, somebody would send me a hate letter, and I would look at it, and I'd say, you need to punch this up. I'm not even going to... This is so much, this is benign compared to most of the stuff I've gotten. Let me show you how to write a good hate letter. You know, use words like apostasy and false prophet and sodomite. You know, get those punch words in there that you think are going to trigger me. Because this is nothing, you know. and now I've got to where I don't even care about that. Like, I don't, it's like it doesn't, it's nearly like that's another planet now. I'm finding it difficult to even remember that world anymore. I'm so removed from it. I live in a world where I know I'm fine. I love my husband. We're out. You know, it just is what it is. And, you know, that's my reality now. But I get the impression that this woman had probably been through enough with these other women that she probably didn't even stop to talk to them anymore. And the fact that she was so candid about, no, I don't have a husband, and he says, you've well said. And then he goes on, and what I really want to concentrate on is verse 23 and 24. He goes on to say, ma'am, there's coming a day. Whew, I just felt the Holy Ghost just then with what I'm about to tell you. He said, there's coming a day when we will no longer worship God in this mountain or in Jerusalem. In other words, the religious icons that your people hold dear or that my people hold dear. I mean, I'm not anti-Israel, but I don't worship Israel either, because even Jesus himself said, there's coming a day we won't even worship in Jerusalem. And Paul came along and talked about the spiritual Israel, and John came and saw a new Jerusalem that was not a piece of real estate in the Middle East. It was the new Jerusalem's a completely different concept. And he refers to him as the father because he's speaking from the patriarchy. He says the father is looking for people like you who will worship him, basically what he was saying, in transparency. King James says in spirit and in truth. But really what he said, let me not get ahead of myself because the anointing's giving me a buzz. Hang on. Sometimes I feel the word of the Lord so strong, it's like it nearly gives me a head rush. He says, the time is coming. We will no longer worship God in this mountain or in Jerusalem. God is looking for people who will just tell the truth about their lives. He says, God, and he goes on in verse 24, he says, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth, in spirit and in transparency, in spirit and in authenticity. And the very fact that he says God is a spirit, like I've had people ask me this before. They'll say, on more than one occasion, I've had people say, do you believe people on the other side, people who have crossed over, do you think they can see us? And I would say, yeah, probably. I mean, I believe we're literally surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And I think heaven's another dimension. I don't think it's a place on the other side of the Milky Way. And then people will say, do you think they can see us like when we're in the bathroom or taking a shower or if we're having sex? And I've always said, spirit beings aren't interested in that. Like, I'm sure they could see it, but it's not, the spirit world's not preoccupied or even interested to the point of noticing manifestations of the flesh. Like, if we could see other people naked, we would be either shocked by it or titillated by it. Spirit beings are in a whole other, like, that doesn't even matter to them. That's why I know when I had that visitation from my grandparents years ago, and when I saw my grandmother say to me about my coming out, and she said, Jamarl, on that side, people care about that kind of stuff, but on this side, nobody cares. I knew it was a word from heaven. I knew it was, because it just so set me free. And I know the stuff that people are preoccupied with in this dimension doesn't matter to spirit beings. So when he says God is a spirit, he's saying God doesn't care if you've been married 5 times or 50 times or 500 times. God doesn't care whether you're married to that man or not. Yeah, that's what people care about. It's like the woman caught in adultery. Jesus said, woman, where are your accusers? She said, I don't have any. And he said, well, then you're good to go. In other words, the sexual condemnation was never coming from God. It was always coming from other people. So when he says God is a spirit, most of the church world has never gained spirituality. They're very preoccupied with the flesh, with the natural. He says God is a spirit, and they that worship him must come up above that and stop being so worried about their reputations. It doesn't matter to spirit beings. Spirit doesn't care what your gender is, what your sexual orientation is, what your sexual history is. Like, that's irrelevant in the spirit realm. That's completely has to do with laws that people, including Moses, made about human sexuality. Even in the Ten Commandments, when he says, thou shalt not commit adultery, that's more about loving somebody. It's more about, you don't commit adultery with another man's wife because you love him, not because you're not sexually attracted to the woman. And you can bear that out when you read the scriptures in context. That's what he says, like, don't covet your neighbor's wife. It's about, because it's written by men to men, it's about you should love your buds enough to not sleep with their women. It's not about the sex sin, it's about the fidelity of friendship. So when he says God is the spirit and they that worship him must worship in spirit and truth, it's amazing because it says that she goes into the next town and she's not put off by it. She's not shamed by it. For those of you who have had to lay your own reputations down, you'll know what I mean by this. If you've suffered abuse from religious Pharisees to the point that it just set you free and you don't really care anymore what they think, then you'll understand what I mean by this. She was not put off by it. She was not like, oh, I repent for having so many men. It's like it was a non-issue. She goes, in fact, she's jazzed about it. She goes in the next city and she says, come meet a man who told me everything I ever did. Now, typically, that would not be a good invitation to most meetings. If somebody said, come to our service tonight and the preacher's going to stand up and tell everybody everything you ever did, most people would say, I think I'll sit this one out. But she didn't feel that way. She's like, it's all out in the open. God's a spirit. I'm a spirit. God tells the truth. I tell the truth. And I worship God in spirit and in truth. I was thinking about this morning. I guess because I was thinking about the thing with Uncle Harry Meshuggah praying for Uncle Harry Swilling. And, you know, I've taught about this before, but I don't hate Pentecostalism. I don't hate the Word of Faith movement. Like, there's parts of all of those things that are still in me. By the time I was born in the middle of the 20th century, Pentecostalism had devolved into it kind of wasn't the same thing it was in the early days of the Pentecostal revival. But when you go back and read, like if you ever hear talk about the Azusa revival, the Azusa revival was a thing that happened in Los Angeles. The Pentecostal like Reformation sort of began in Topeka, Kansas at a Bible college there, but then it rapidly moved to Los Angeles. There was a mission that was there on Azusa Street. It's no longer there. It's just like a little wooden mission, but for some reasons, signs and wonders started happening there. And people of all ethnicities were coming together there, and like the blind were seeing, the deaf were hearing. It was like the day of Pentecost. And I think the reason I thought of it this morning is when my Uncle Harry Meshegan's family came from Armenia, they settled in Los Angeles. And my Uncle Harry's father and uncle were walking down Azusa Street, and they heard someone, what they thought was preaching in Armenian. So they went into the Azusa mission, and it wasn't a guy speaking Armenian, it was a man speaking in tongues. And it was like the day of Pentecost. He was American, but he was speaking Armenian to them, and he prophesied to them what they should do. And so they were instrumental in bringing Amy Semple McPherson down from Canada when she established Angelus Temple. And I know some of you have no idea what I'm talking about, but this is a lot of Pentecostal history, and she started the Four Square Gospel. And anyway, that's why I was thinking about this today. And what happened with the Azusa revival, it just broke out like wildfire. People were coming from all over the United States, maybe from all over the world, to be a part of this great supernatural move of God. But then it started to bother people that like black men were in there praying with white women. And so they decided, like, we're not saying this isn't of God. We're saying we need to harness it, organize it, and control it. And that's why any of you that are watching that came out of Kojic, the Church of God in Christ, Daddy Seymour, Father William Seymour, what happened was they took the life of the Pentecostal explosion, which that's the part of Pentecostalism that I love. That's the part of Pentecostalism that I'm proud of, is they were supernatural, they were out of the box, they let women preach, they believed in signs and wonders. The other stuff, the legalism, the eschatology, I can do without all of that. A lot of the fire was put out when the Scofield Bible was introduced to them, and they started standing out on the hillside looking for Jesus to come back instead of doing what the book of Acts was told them to do. But what happened was they sort of divided it up, and like the white people went and started the Church of God and the Assemblies of God, and the black people went and started Church of God in Christ. And it's interesting, when you go back and you read God is a spirit and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth, it's interesting, and this is going to sound like a cynical statement, but I don't think I'm overstating this. The majority of what modern church is now is anything but the truth. Like, church is like for most people, is like a masquerade party where they act in a way that is not really how they are. Because if people know how they are, they might, a lot of church world is built on anthropological phenomenon of tribal shaming. I mean, there's, 46,000 Christian denominations? That's a lot of tribal shaming. That's a lot of excommunicating one group to start another group. The very fact, Christianity as a religion invalidates itself by the simple fact there's so many denominations. There's only 27 books of the New Testament. The fact that there's that much division over those 27 books means there's something intrinsically wrong with it. I said the other day, Christianity was the worst thing that ever happened to Jesus, and I completely stand by that. Jesus never meant to start a church. And if you, you know, if you really think Jesus is about to come back at any minute, why are you buying church buildings? Why are you, why aren't you going from door to door preaching the gospel? Why are you, why aren't you selling everything you have and giving it to the poor? If that's what you really believe, then put your money where your mouth is. I believe we are the second coming of Christ, so I don't feel a conflict in that. And when I read God is a spirit and they that worship him a spirit worship him in spirit and truth, I think, well, I got it. I tell you the, I'm happy to tell you the truth. It sets you free to hear the truth. And I remember, and this is no shade on my dad, because this is the system he came out of, but I remember, those of you that are in my age group may remember the advent of color television. Now, I've always watched TV. I was an only child. I didn't have a lot of people to play with, so TV was a major player in my childhood. And, oh my God, I wanted a color TV so bad, and my cousin Mark had one, and every time we'd go, I'd go to his house, I said, Dad, can we please get a color TV? And one day, I vividly remember that Zenith color television. I came home from school, and he came wheeling it in there into the kitchen. It was on wheels, and it was those old school color TVs where they had a tint wheel and a hue wheel, and you can make everybody green, and you can make everybody purple, which I just thought was the coolest thing I've ever seen. And to be able to see Batman in color, I'm like, the Riddler's hat is lavender. I never knew that, because I'd always been watching it in black and white. Oh my God, it ranks up there with one of the happiest days of my childhood. And his first words were, do not tell anybody in the church we got this. Why? Because I don't want anybody to know. It sounds extravagant. And it couldn't have cost that much for this little portable color TV. I don't even know what size it was, but I mean, I don't remember the dimensions. But it immediately, it was like it was given and taken away. It was like, here it is, and you immediately need to feel ashamed of it and lie about it. Don't tell anybody about it. My maternal grandfather in the late 40s got a television, and they kept it in the closet because it was considered worldly to watch TV. So what happens when you raise children in that environment, you teach them, it doesn't matter what you really believe. It matters what the board thinks. It matters what Sister So-and-so thinks. It matters what the mother's board thinks. It's like you never really develop an actual relationship with God based on your belief system. Everything is about appearances. Everything is about, you can't wear that to church because what will Sister So-and-so think about that? You know, some of y'all came out of those churches where some woman comes in with a short skirt and people say, oh, she ain't saved. She couldn't be saved and wear a skirt like that. So everything comes about pleasing people. When Jesus asked the modern day church people, where are your accusers? You can say, the church is full of them. The church is full of accusers. All I hear is accusation. That's why when people say, what was it like being in the closet? I'm like, in the closet? I wasn't in the closet. I came from a world where you weren't even supposed to go to movies. We did go to them, but I was sworn into secrecy. You know, again, it's like, don't just make sure Sister So-and-so doesn't know about it, because she'll gossip about it. And you know, I was raised with that whole thing about, you know, women weren't supposed to wear jewelry or makeup or pants or whatever. I said, so the closet would have been freedom. I would have never even imagined being free enough to be in the closet. I just knew who I was. But man, I had to keep that in a vault 60 feet under the ground. So the majority of church world is people being a certain way during the week and then coming together for church services and acting in a different way. And I know it's true because just by the amount of gossip that I was raised with, not necessarily in my home, but just like church world, the churches I grew up in were built on gossip. Everybody gossiped about everybody. Everybody judged everybody else for how holy you are, how much makeup was she wearing, how long was her hair, did you go to a dance, did you go to, you know, did you smoke a cigarette, what did you watch on TV? So everything was about that. There was no such thing as live and let live, or love people unconditionally, or restore someone. It was all about what people think. And what I want to exhort you, and most of you already know this, most of you are already on this trajectory with me, but the more you know God, the real God, not the idol that people set up based on bibliolatry, where people don't worship the true God, they worship a collection of books that ancient people wrote about their consciousness of God. That's why there's no fresh revelation, because people are locked into a word of the past. That's why it was such a radical thing when Jesus said, "You have heard it said, but I say." Most churches don't allow for the "but I say." They're totally fixated on "you've heard it said." What I want to say to you, and I don't think he will mind me saying this. I don't know if my son Jared's watching today. I can't really see the screen right now. He watches most Sundays, and if he doesn't watch, he'll text me and say, I missed it today, but I'll catch you next week. And I don't think he'll mind me saying that he's very involved in a 12-step program right now. Not only for himself, but helping other people. And it's been kind of cool, especially these last 6 months. I know that he's passed a 6-month sobriety time, and I'm not sure where he is on it now. Jared, just allow me to say this if you're watching, because I'm very proud of you. We've been able to compare notes, because usually what he'll tell me is, what you taught today sounds so similar to what I said in a group or what's, and because the whole thing about AA and NA is people just telling the truth. It's like, part of the original declaration is we recognize we were powerless over this thing in our life, and we had to call, you know, we needed help. That's why it's called anonymous. And I know I'm outing him, but like I said, I don't think he'll mind me saying it. And the reason I'm bringing it up is I was thinking this week about, you know, there's a lot of white fragility right now about critical race theory being taught in the schools. And one school system has reacted to it so strongly that not only have they said you can't teach critical race theory, they've taken slavery and Dr. Martin Luther King out of the history books altogether, as if they never existed. And I think, white people, you honestly think we all don't know what happened with American slavery and what still happens with systematic racism? And the clearest indication that there is privilege is if you don't see it. If you say, I don't see any privilege anywhere, it's like a fish not seeing water. It's because it's everywhere. You've grown up with it, so you don't even notice it. And look, I don't, you know, believe me, every time one of those 12 Years a Slave movies comes out, I go see it, and I'm like, here we go. We have to see white people are monsters, and, you know, I'm usually the only white guy in the theater, and, you know, it just is what it is. But I don't deny that that is a reality. I don't hate white people. White people have done some amazing things. The Europeans who settled this country, aside from being slave owners and committing genocide to the First Nation people, they were incredible visionaries. They were walking in the light that they had. I don't want to leave America. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't think anybody else does. But you're never going to... things are never going to get better if you can't even just tell the truth, even if the truth hurts. And the reason I brought Jared up is a few months ago, those of you that have been through, I know some of you watching today have been through this. One of the steps, I forget which one it is, I think it's number 9, is you have to go make amends with anybody that your addiction may have hurt. And so Jared, he doesn't live in Atlanta now, but he came into town and he met with both his brothers and had a time with them, but he also met with me. And I let him say his whole thing, and I made it a point to be quiet and let him say what he needed to say. But after I was sure he had said all of his stuff, I said, well, let me ask you this. I feel like some of the things you've said to me or tweeted to me in the last few years, I keep detecting this real anger that you have toward me, and whatever it is, I want to know what it is, because I don't want to get down to the end of my life like I ended up with my dad. And still, my dad, I challenged his comfort zones a lot, and he did the best he could with the information that he had, but we still left so many things unsaid. And I said, I don't want to be that way with you. If there's an issue with us, tell me what it is, because I want to make it right. Because I'm sorry that your mother and I got divorced when you were very young. I'm sure that sucked, and I can't take that. I can't change that. But if there's something else that I need to know about, tell me. I want us to be good with each other completely. And he said, I'm telling you, I don't have any issue with you. It's all me and my perception because of the situation in my life. And I remember a couple of years back, I'd gone through a thing with him, and I tweeted Christina about it, my daughter. And I said, can you believe this thing that Jared said to me? And Christina comes back with something even worse. Like, she had all this unresolved stuff and stuff that she had heard in her childhood that was so not true. And we were able to talk it out, and I was so glad we were able to talk about it, because I said, I can't believe somebody said I said that. I never said anything like that or even thought that. And so our relationship got much better after that. Jared's and my relationship is very, I mean, my four children are my four best friends. And I want to be able to tell the truth, even if I wasn't a fantastic father, or if there's some way I'm not now, then tell me what it is. I want to own it. You can't be so afraid of the truth, whether you're, you know, look, white people, some of our history is really ugly. Until you're willing to look at it, you cannot heal it. And you keep acting like it's not there or not true, you're just going to prolong it to another generation. And I'll tell you this, the generation that is being raised now, the generation that was raised with the internet, the generation that was raised with access to pornography, the generation that was raised with 24-hour cable television that tells all, they're not going to be able to sustain lies like we have now. Even this current thing that's happening now with the great lie that the election was stolen, eventually even that will die off and the truth will emerge. And the good news is you don't have to be afraid of the truth. It's the most liberating thing in the world. When that woman said, come meet a man who told me everything I ever did, I'm not talking about making yourself a doormat for people to tell you. I don't want to hear that. I mean, Lord knows I block people all the time. All the time. I blocked somebody the other day, a great music producer who, you know, I had a history with. But I put a picture I always put a picture of me every day on my meditations. And he wrote on my Facebook page, you really think you're cute, don't you? And I thought, nope, you're not allowed to talk to me that way. Block. And it's not that I'm super sensitive. It's like, no, you're projecting something on me that I don't do to other people. And I work hard on those meditations every day. People steal my stuff all the time. I put my picture on it just like people put their pictures on book jacket covers. And I make no apology for that. It's my way of visiting with you and personalizing it. And if you don't respect me enough to not say something like that, I'm going to have to block you. I don't think you're a bad person, but you've lost privileges with me. So I don't want to hear negative stuff like that. But if somebody really needs to tell you the truth and you're in a safe space with them, don't be afraid of the truth. When Jesus said, yeah, you don't have a husband, you've had five and you're living with a man now, she's like, that's what I'm talking about. Jesus said, the Father's looking for people just like you. It's amazing that so much of Christian denominations is based on anything but the truth. You know, it's funny. Back when we had church in the now, I'm not saying this never happened, and there's no way I can know everything that was going on. But I used to talk to other churches that really had that, other pastors that had that old school, hardline holiness preaching. And they would tell me, like when we have pastors' meetings, they'd say, do you have a problem with just everybody sleeping with everybody in your church? I'm like, not that I'm aware of. I'm like, no, maybe a couple of times over all the years I've heard of some in, but there's no, these people would be like, no, like nobody in our church wears makeup and they don't smoke cigarettes and they don't go to movies, but behind closed doors, everybody's wife swapping and they're being swingers. I said, man, that's some serious crazy stuff. It's like, as long as you come to church and look a certain way, and everybody thought Church in the Now was so worldly because I was so open-minded, and we were kind of in that community like one of the least, we weren't like that at all, because the more you tell, the people who really just tell the truth about their life don't have anything to hide. Always, there's a reason why Shakespeare said, I know I'm not quoting this right, but he said, methinks thou dost protest too much. Usually, if a man's up preaching against homosexuals all the time, he's probably gay and he's dealing with his own self-loathing. Because people project onto other people their own religiosity. Don't be afraid of the truth. The truth will make you free. God is a spirit. Spirit beings live in the real world. Spirit beings don't have to wear the mask. Spirit beings don't have to have pretense. Spirit beings don't care what Sister So-and-so thinks. Spirit beings aren't worried about the board. Spirit beings just tell the truth. I mean, really, if you think about it, the most truthful statement you can make is, I am. Just, I am. There it is. I am. I'm not even trying to convince you I am good or I am holy. I just am. There's so much more to that we've even discovered yet. Just the liberation of the I am. This is who I am. Without apology. I feel like I want to burst into a chorus of just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. I love, it's a beautiful song. And that thou bidst me come to thee, O Lamb of God, I come. Man, that's some powerful stuff. Yeah, it was a good sermon. I know it was. Tell me about it. I cannot wait to see you next Sunday. Be there, 11 o'clock. Live your real life. Tell the truth. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. I love you. Bye.